Okay. Thank you so much for the opportunity to speak to you today. Again, thank you for the introduction, Jim. My name is Michael Esselin. I am not the chaplain at UCLA Medical Center. I'm one of many chaplains at UCLA Medical Center, and I work primarily with end-stage oncology patients and with adult psychiatric patients, and I also work with palliative care patients at Santa Monica UCLA Medical Center. I've been very honored to be part of GLIDE. I'm one of the co-founders. We just celebrated our 10th anniversary last year. We are a nonprofit, all-volunteer, anti-homophobia speakers bureau. We speak primarily to student populations in the Los Angeles area. We've spoken to over 100,000 people in our first 10 years at over 2,000 individual engagements. Last year, we made 300 presentations in the LA area. We not only speak in schools, but we also speak to groups of teachers, to businesses at the Museum of Tolerance in Los Angeles, to churches, to anyone that will welcome a discussion about the topic of homophobia. A number of years ago, when we had a different occupant in the White House, which now sadly feels like an eternity to me, but Mr. Clinton had the audacity to suggest that the federal workplace should be a safe and welcoming environment for all employees, regardless of their sexual orientation. So GLIDE got a few calls to do engagements at federal agencies around town. One day I was collecting messages off the GLIDE voicemail, and I heard, "Hello, this is Clara W. Jones at the IRS. But this isn't about your taxes." Clara was calling to set up an engagement for GLIDE to come speak to the IRS employees at the main office in downtown Los Angeles. Clara was a lovely and loving older woman for whom I had the sense that this was kind of uncharted territory for her as well, but she wanted to do the right thing, and she led with an open and loving heart. I arrived to the conference room a little bit early, and I saw who must have been Clara trudging up the stairs with one bag of groceries for refreshments and one bag of decorations, because I just thought it should have a festive atmosphere. So soon enough, she started directing her employees to start blowing up balloons. And one of the young men noticed very quickly, "Clara, these balloons say happy birthday on them." And Clara was pretty mortified but undeterred, and she said, "Oh, well, just can't you put that happy birthday part sort of toward the wall and mercy." So anyway, we got the room decorated. We had our dialogue. It was a wonderful conversation. And toward the end of the question and answer period, Clara made more of a declaration than a comment or a question, really. She just said, "Michael, I just want to thank you for coming down here and opening up our hearts and minds. And I guess when it all comes right down to it, we're just the same, and it's nobody's business anyway." It's not an uncommon point of view, and maybe some of you share that point of view. But I disagreed with Clara then, and I disagree with her still. There are a few cultural myths and stereotypes that are embedded in such a statement, and I think addressing each of those is indeed everyone's business. The first one would suggest that sexual orientation is really only about sexual behavior, what does or doesn't happen in your bedroom, and therefore it's private and it's nobody's business. The second myth is closely linked but significantly different. Is one that would say, "I don't need to know that about you in order to know you, because you're just like me, except for who you love or what you do or don't do in your bedroom." And the third assumption reflected in her statement is that coming out is just something that gay folks do, and maybe their families, and then they only do it once and we never have to hear about it again. I'd like to address each of those in a little more detail. That first myth that would say that sexual orientation is really only about what does or doesn't happen in your bedroom, it's about behavior. I invite you to reflect just a moment on your own sexual orientation right now, whatever it is. For most of you, I assume it's heterosexual. Is that sexual orientation only expressed in your bedroom? Is it also expressed in who you talk about? Who matters to you? Who do you talk about at work? Why are you in a good mood? Why are you in a bad mood? Whose picture's on your desk or in your wallet? Whose wedding ring do you perhaps wear? With whom have you built a family? With whom are your finances inextricably linked? Who do you want at your side at the best time of your life or the worst time of your life? Who do you make reference to in public to perfect strangers? "Give that to my husband over there in the green shirt." All of those things might sound innocent and benign, but they are all reflections of your sexual orientation. And it's nobody's business, I would suggest that our sexual orientation is one of the primary lenses through which we view our lives, also one of the primary building blocks upon which our lives are built. That second assumption, that one that's closely linked, that would say, I don't need to know that about you in order to know you because you're just like me except for what you do in your bedroom or who you love. That one seems almost kind of benign, maybe even kind of enlightened, very common. Maybe some of you hold that same belief. But that one to me is the most insidious, particularly if we have any intention or meaning in what we say in this covenant of having meaningful relationships with the larger circle of life and the community of life. I don't think we can really have a meaningful relationship with someone unless we're first really, really willing to walk through the doorway of difference of whatever it is that appears to separate us, be it our sexual orientation, be it age, be it race, be it gender, be it social or economic class, be it health status. How can I really say I know you unless I first really find out what's it like to be you? I would never dream of saying to a person of color, for instance, you're just like me except for the color of your skin. I enjoy enormous privilege in this culture as a man and as a white man. I have never had a woman hold her purse tighter to her side because I stepped on the elevator. Nobody has ever locked their car door because I walk in front of them in a crosswalk. Nobody has ever followed me around in the store because I look like I would steal something. No police officer has ever stopped me because I didn't look like I belonged in the neighborhood. I can't begin to know what kind of a bite those experiences would take out of a person's soul or how those very experiences can shape a person's soul. So how dare I say you are just like me except for the color of your skin unless I'm first really willing with intention to find out what's it like to be you. But in a similar way, as a gay man and one who grew up as a gay child in this culture, I am acutely aware of heterosexual privilege in a way that most people in the dominant culture of heterosexuality are mostly unconscious. My experience of my difference is profoundly different than heterosexuals growing up. And I imagine as a liberally minded, socially conscious congregation, we're all aware of the greater social inequities that exist for gay, lesbian, bisexual, transgender people. That we cannot serve openly in the military. That in 33 states we can still be fired from our jobs simply because of our sexual orientation. We can't be legally married in the United States, except in the state of Massachusetts, and there only for residents of Massachusetts, and even that is under attack. We're aware of these big things. But sometimes it's the smaller, most inconsequential aspects of life that can bring social inequity into a kind of relief, that marginalization, to really make it visible. A number of years ago, my partner Scott and I went to the wedding of an old college friend of mine up in the Bay Area, a very formal, very conservative Jewish wedding. The bride was the only person we knew. There didn't appear to be any other gay couples there. Well, as is the case at most weddings, afterward a reception, they had great music, great dancing. I'm an old dancer, I love to dance, put a little Stevie Wonder on, I'm ready to go. Am I going to get up and dance with Scott? What about Grandma? What about the bride? What about the rabbi? What about their family? It's their day, better not cause a scene. No, forget it, we better teach them a lesson. This is part of life. Get up and dance. No, you better not. We'll just sit here and tap our feet. Granted, it couldn't be less important. It couldn't be less significant. But I don't think any heterosexual person in this audience has ever spent so much time consternating about whether to dance or not. Do you or don't you? I think we minimize and even dismiss a minority's experience of their difference and their lack of privilege in a culture when we're so quick to jump to that place of, oh, you're just like me. That third assumption that would say that coming out is just something gay folks do and they only do it once and then we never have to hear about it again, I would suggest that coming out is something that we all do every time we dare to tell the truth about ourselves. The real truth. The stuff where we have to reveal our fears and our despair and our sorrow and our joy and our dreams and our hurts. It's a big thing to do that. It is no small thing to do that. Because in order to do that, we have to risk facing the expectations others have of us, of who we are, and maybe disappointing them. We have to face those expectations of ourselves, who we find ourselves to be. We have to even risk finding out who it is that we are, because we spend a lot of time pretending we're not. Wow, what a racist thought. Was that me? What a jealous thought. Was that me? We have to face maybe even losing relationships altogether. We have to face our own cultural ennoblement of stoicism. How much we revere people who don't complain. One of my grandmothers died in 1989, and she was a very tough gal. And I heard a lot at her funeral. Boy, she suffered a lot, and you never heard her complain. Like, that's a great thing. And I understand that. Nobody likes to be around a complainer and a whiner. But as her grandson, I always felt like I never quite knew her. I never quite knew what it was like to be here, because she had that facade of self-reliance. And nobody, like I say, wants to be around that. But do we deny people and life around us from truly understanding who we are when we are so busy focusing on that self-reliance? As a hospital chaplain, and particularly one dealing with oncology patients, in a way I feel like I'm in the coming out business. My job is, in a way, to create a safe place, a safe space for people to come out to me, to tell me their truth, often at the most critical time of their life, at the end of it, to tell me their joys, their regrets, their sorrows, their fears. And even at that, I got to tell you, if you're inpatient oncology at UCLA Medical Center, you're in trouble. How many times I go into the door, knock, hey, I'm Michael, I'm the chaplain here, just want to introduce myself, see if you feel like talking, how's it going? I'm great, just fine. Really? Really? How is that possible? A number of years ago, when I was beginning my internship as a chaplain, this is a midlife career change for me, we had so many clinical hours that we had to put in each week, and I was going through kind of a rough patch of depression myself, and there was a day I thought, you know what, I just can't go in today. I don't have anything to give to anybody else. And then I thought, you know what, if I'm serious about this chaplaincy thing, I better just go show up and, just as an experiment, see what my chaplaincy looks like when I'm running on empty myself. So I went in. I was assigned to neurosurgery and trauma at the time. First room I walked into, older woman in bed, her family was surrounded by her, and I walked in and said, I'm Michael, I'm the chaplain, I just wanted to say hi. She cut me right off, said, oh, please come in, chaplain, I'm so glad you're here. I need help thanking God. I'm the luckiest woman in the world. I've got a brain tumor, but it's benign and it's operable and they can fix it. And I've got my family here, and my priest was here, and he said how great I am because I don't complain. Not that I don't have a lot to complain about, mind you. But of course, I took it as a golden opportunity to annihilate myself. Great, she's got a brain tumor and she can't thank God enough, and I'm ready to jump off a bridge because of my piddly stuff. But looks can be deceiving, because the very next day I went in to see her, and this day she was alone. I said, hi, would you like to talk? Come in, pull up a chair. She opened with, I'm worried I'm not going to get into heaven because I have so much anger and bitterness and resentment in my heart. Yesterday, it was living up to expectations. That was the lie. That was the mask. And she was good at it. I had the feeling she spent her whole life doing it, and doing it well. I bought it. Hook, line, and sinker. I imagine a lot of us are good at it. I'm good at it. But today, I was getting the truth. Because for the next 45 minutes, wave after wave of unredeemable regret, of ill-placed values, of bitterness, of sorrow, and no time left to make good on any of it. This was a woman in her later 70s. It washed over me like so much sewage spewing from a ruptured pipeline. She was coming out to me, at last, to somebody. And the thing is, there was healing in that, because in just being heard, in being accepted as she is, no need to change it. And the funny thing was, it for me, I was running on empty, like I say. I heard her in a different way than if I had a full tank of gas. Because there was none of that urge within me that wanted to reframe it, put a little positive, encouraging spin on it. I could just let it be. And it wasn't just her healing in that, it was mine too. Because I got to experience maybe this much more grace for my own journey, for my own stuff. A little bit more respect. And that healing speaks to why it is everybody's business, because isn't that what it's about? Greater self-knowledge, self-acceptance, greater sense of community, connection with others. The truth is, we don't ever begin to know ourselves except by the dance we do with each other. And it's often a dance of opposites. I don't think we would really know what passion is if we don't also have the experience of indifference. And I don't think we know what intimacy is if we don't know isolation. And we sure don't know what acceptance is if we don't also know judgment. And we don't know what heterosexuality is if we don't know what it means to be gay, to be lesbian, to be bisexual, to be transgender. When I was in junior high, 7th grade, a million years ago in Long Beach, there was a new policy. All students had to study a foreign language. Huge uproar in the community. These kids can't even speak English yet. Why are we teaching them a foreign language? The thinking was that by studying a foreign language, we come to understand our own better. It worked for me. I never had to think about language like I had to then. Wait a minute. Everybody doesn't put an adjective in front of a noun. What's that about? That dialogue, and given the chance, all kinds of sexual minorities, gay folks, lesbian folks, bisexual folks, transgender folks, can really help more mainstream kind of folks understand what things like gender and sexual orientation really mean. And that dialogue isn't just about creating more meaningful relationships in our own inner circle and our own even smaller communities. It's really about social justice. We've seen a lot of progress made with respect to gay and lesbian folks in the last few years. AB 537 passed in California a few years ago that said that all school children in California in public schools have to be in safe environments for all kids, regardless of sexual orientation or perceived sexual orientation. We had a Supreme Court decision a couple years ago that overturned the anti-sodomy laws in the United States. We have increased domestic partnership benefits here in the state of California. All of these strides and progress did not happen in a vacuum. And they did not happen because people said, it's none of my business. They happened because people have dared to become visible. And becoming visible changes minds, changes hearts. It opens them up and it binds them together. Whether it's around an old woman with a brain tumor or whether it's around sexual orientation. I invite you to think about the closet doors that exist in your own lives today. I know they're there. And what your relationship is to those doors. Which side of the door are you on? You holding it closed from the inside? Trying to yank it open from the outside? Trying to pretend like it doesn't exist? What would you like that relationship to be? Do you want to be the WD-40 that gets squirted on the hinges to help those doors open easily? What about the children that are in your world? We saw a whole stage full of them today. Some of them are wrestling with this issue. There are gay and lesbian kids out there. There's little lesbian infants. There's little gay toddlers. Are you the person that that child is going to feel safe to come to and talk to without judgment and have an open mind about it? And if so, good for you. And how did you get to be that way? And if you're not, why aren't you? And what are you going to do about it to become that? When I was working in that neurosurgery and trauma unit, there was a young man, 11 years old, in the ICU who had taken a gun to his own head. And he only lived a few days. But in those few days of being with his parents, it became very clear to me that that young man was wrestling with being gay, and it wasn't even on the table. Some folks have an issue with GLIDE even coming into certain school districts. Oh, well, our kids are too young for that. You know, maybe to the older high school students, but what does a third grader need to know about that? Too late for this kid. It was too late for this kid. So that really does speak to why it's everybody's business. I don't think any of us want to see our grandchildren, nieces, nephews, our own children in that hospital bed and saying, oops, we forgot to ever talk about this. I just assumed that they were all straight. I'd like to leave you with the words of Jean-Paul Sartre. In order to get any truth about myself, I must have contact with another. The other is indispensable to my own existence as well as to my knowledge about myself. This being so, in discovering my inner being, I discover the other person at the same time.